Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this last programme in this series, in a way, we're starting off by resuming some of our themes from the very outset. And one of the themes from the very outset was the difficulty of assessing what one means by German history, and indeed Germany. And this issue isn't helped by the fact that the nature of Germanness has itself been politically vexed and is still contentious. So at the very most basic of levels, is the history of Germany the history of what is now the German state, as expanded as a result of the unification of West and East Germany? Or is it a history less distinct, less specific of whatever one means by Germans or Germanness? And if one means something by Germans, one needs to be aware that Germans these days include, for example, the large number of people of Turkish origins living in Germany, just as they might include those who are, as it were, self-defining as Bavarians or Saxons. So these issues are not easy. And then on top of that, they are interwoven with the question of whether there was a distinctive path in German history, a Sonderweg, an idea that sort of developed most clearly from the 19th century, and or if there was a distinctive path, how far did that lead necessarily or just contingently to the particular catastrophes of German history of the 20th century, most profoundly the catastrophe of the Third Reich, a catastrophe one needs to remember for Germans as well as for everybody else between 1933 and 1945, but also the catastrophes posed to Germans by partition between 1945 and the end of East Germany, and separately the catastrophe posed by German aggression and its role in causing World War I, which again was a catastrophe for Germans and for others. Now, it would be foolish if I was to pretend that there was a clear-cut answer to this question. And indeed, one of the things I find truly depressing about many of the shorter recent accounts of German history to have appeared is that they do, as it were, pretend that there is one. I noticed one in particular, one popular short account, which argued that there was a clear divide in German history between that part of Germany which had been under Roman rule and that part that, as it were, was on the other side of the Elbe, and that these created a dichotomy which explained the course of German history. That's a very naive approach. It's a form of geographical determinism, which, as it were, negates the extent to which there were always powerful cross currents within particular areas of, in theory, geographical similarity. And it also underplays the extent to which human beings and their actions are able to affect historical processes. So a kind of Braudelian view of thinking here about the French, as it were, geographical determinist Ferdinand Braudel, a kind of Braudelian view of German history is not very helpful. It is also not very helpful to imagine that in some way the modern geographical boundaries of Germany emerged clearly from a chrysalis of the past. Because, of course, to go back to an earlier point, Zurich and Vienna are simultaneously cities in Switzerland and Austria, but they are also cities of what one might think of as a German world, and certainly for much of the history of those places were part of a German world. So what I tried to do, and I don't want to just give a reheated version of it, in my sort of concluding historical chapter of my brief history of Germany, is to pose these questions and to argue that political turning points were precisely that, that there was no necessity for, as it were, 1914 or 1933, and that precisely because of that, the tendency, both at the time and subsequently by commentators and by later by historians, to try and explain what happened and to make it appear inevitable, repeatedly runs up against the question, well, what would have happened had that not been the case? Would, for example, the First Reich have come to an end but for Napoleon? It might be easy to say yes or no. I can tell you, having written a book on international relations and war in that period and strategy, I cannot clearly say to you yes or no. And what I would argue is that it is, as it were, foolish people that rush in and explain history as if it is a branch of political rhetoric. Now, Graham, I've set that as a kind of agenda because I know you've got some questions and points you want to raise, but I hope we can use that as a departure point.
Well, I think we can. And I mean, you raise so many, even just in these brief moments, you raise so many interesting questions. There's always the issue of events happen and then historians and others try and join the dots to previous events to prove that these things were inevitable or that at any rate they happened through a coherent process of events, one leading to the other. I mean, it seems to me quite clear that Germany did not have to invade Belgium in 1940. Hitler was not an inevitable process of the Treaty of Versailles and so on. I wonder just to start just to probe a little bit more on the subject you raised of geographical determinism. I mean, it's an interesting subject. I mean, not least because the boundaries of Germany have shifted. Are we talking about the German peoples, including what is now Austria, for example? Even the boundary with France has over Lorraine and Alsace-Lorraine has shifted back and forth over time. I wonder, though, are there some coherent aspects that geography has helped make the German political and cultural identity? I mean, there's been research in recent years, for example, which suggests that areas of Germany, which in the Middle Ages had pogroms against Jews, were also the areas in the 1930s and 40s that demonstrated the most zealous support for the Nazi Party, with the assumption we're asked to make from this that there was something inherent in these regions that made them predisposed towards extremism against the Jewish population. Do you buy into at least some of those ideas, or do you think these things are essentially coincidental?
Well, that's interesting. As you may know, I wrote a book, or in fact two books, on geopolitics, the latter, the bigger one, published by the University of Indiana. And I've always been wary of the deterministic aspects of geopolitics. Clearly, geography is a factor, and one would be foolish to ignore it, just as, for example, at the most basic of levels, there is coal in area A, there is oil in area B. These affect what happens in those areas. But what I'm very wary of is a notion of determinism and B, a hierarchy of causal factors. And I think that is a nature of historical analysis, political debate, that is based on value judgments rather than any inherent proof or the absence of it. Now, you ask about boundaries, and it's worth bearing in mind that what we call Germany or the German lands or the area inhabited by those who were regarded as ethnically German expanded considerably to the east over a period of at least 500 years in, shall we say, 900 to 1400, but continuing thereafter. And I'm not quite sure that I actually am therefore happy with the notion of any particular fixed boundaries of a Germany, let alone the fact that, of course, as I, you know, discussed extensively, in the idea of the German Empire as being a state akin to that, by which I mean the First Empire, the First Reich, as being a state akin to that of a modern state is problematic, which is historical speak for a load of rubbish. So I'm more inclined to argue that the value of history in this context, history is the question of discussing the past, rests precisely on a sense of the plasticity of the past. That plasticity itself was used by, recognized by many of the key leaders in German history, modern German history, whether you're thinking of Frederick the Great, whether you're thinking of his opponent, the Emperor Joseph II, for that matter, whether you're thinking of Bismarck, or whether you're thinking of Adolf Hitler, or not in any way to suggest any equivalence, whether you're thinking of Chancellor Kohl at the end of the 1980s, beginning of the 1990s. So all of them recognize that there was a plasticity to the nature of Germany territorially. And indeed, I think one could add in terms of the political structures and the relationships between state and people. And given that that is the case, it seems rather odd to ignore the lived experience that they represented in many senses, rather unpleasantly so. I'm not talking about Chancellor Kohl here, but I'm talking about the other figures. So, no, I would be very wary about the notion of some sort of fixed boundary. And you could actually take it further. And, you know, I was referring to the eastward expansion of German settlement and political organization, and indeed one could add a Christian Episcopal organization in what we call the Middle Ages. You could argue, if you like, that Frederick the Great, in terms of the first partition of Poland, his successor in terms of the territorial gains from the second and third partitions of Poland, you could argue that they're an attempted part of the same process, albeit within different contexts. And then, of course, you could suggest, not in any way that I'm providing any justification, that there is an element to which, of course, Nazi expansionism fits into this notion of a Germany or German lands that dominate those to the east. And of course, you could add the parallel Austrian expansionism, and if you wanted to, emphasize the Austrian character or the Danubian ambitions of Hitler. So I think one has to be very careful in implying some inevitability. One can see parallels, but that doesn't mean that those parallels were obvious, either in terms of the ambitions or in terms of the means followed.
Well, the geography is one aspect. Another very interesting one, which we've been discussing over many of the episodes in this series, is of course religion. That Germany and the German lands are, you know, can't be compared to countries like unified Italy, where essentially you're either Roman Catholic or you're irreligious. Likewise, France, where you're likely secular, apart from a minority who are religious. It is a country which has been left from the Reformation with quite a profound difference between Catholic Germany and Protestant Germany, and this has taken on relevance beyond purely the religious sphere. I mean, politically as well. You've spoken in recent episodes about the predominantly Catholic identity of the CDU, at least until such time as Angela Merkel, who's Protestant, was Chancellor. How has this divide, this religious post-Reformation religious divide, has this been something that you know Germany has united despite this, or has there been? Do you see it as a kind of an acceptance between these two different Germanies, three different, if you now include secular Germanies, that actually was able to overcome this very successfully through other means?
Well, that's very interesting. And can I add, of course, one needs to be aware, and this is something that I suspect historians of the future, and certainly many commentators of the present, are aware, that there is now, whether you're talking about Germany or France, Italy or Britain, a significant Islamic population. So the religious dimension is now much more complex than it was, and with difficulties in terms of a clear-cut sense of confidence in the necessary relationship between religious groups. So, but leaving that aside, if we're just thinking in terms of Germany, as you say, the political territorialization of statehood in Germany over the last two centuries, since, as it were, the end of the First Reich and the political settlement at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, that was accompanied by a re-evaluation of the role of religion, because in a sense, the German wars of religion had become interwoven with the structure of the First Reich, creating a kind of modus vivendi, always tense, always unsettled, but nevertheless, without in the 18th century the degree of sort of antisocial violence at a high level seen, for example, in the 30 Years' War. And what I think one could say is that, yes, religious pluralism created all sorts of issues, from those of individual families and their marital patterns to those of society as a whole, but that the prime difference in the 19th and 20th century is that the level of political dysfunctionality involved, as opposed to political identification involved, was one that became much less. And you're absolutely right. You know, we have discussed the role of Catholicism, political Catholicism, in the CDU, and there's no doubt it was important. But it is also the case that the tensions arising as a result were handled without violence in West Germany, throughout the West German system. And that, I think, is important and is valuable. And of course, we are more aware of that significance as we look around the world and consider how, including in the European context, in the former Yugoslavia, a religious or for that matter in Northern Ireland, religious pluralism did not have that so benign a consequence.
Yes, I mean, it seems to me we almost, because, I mean, I'm talking obviously the period after the 30 Years' War, but since then, it's been part of the German achievement that religious differences haven't balled into the sort of sectarian conflict that other European countries and
I've argued in other works that there was a degree. I mean, for example, the wars between Prussia and Austria, there was clearly a religious dimension. Certainly in the Silesian conflicts of the 1740s and 1750s, and you could argue right up to 1866. But the point is, they were less intense than hitherto. And I think it's fair to say that when you move to the mass political parties of the late 19th, early 20th century, they are not the cause of the violence which we are to see, the street violence we are to see in Weimar Germany, and then the violence which is the prelude and accompaniment to the Third Reich. I mean, the Third Reich was a vicious, dangerous, horrific episode of anti-societal violence at every level. But interestingly enough, as far as the religious dimension was concerned, insofar as it was religious violence, it was the religious violence around a kind of worship of the Führer, which is what Nazism was in many respects. I mean, it was a parody of religion, the Third Reich, and I think should be approached in that fashion. But it wasn't something, although it had, you know, roots in earlier history, it didn't just begin in 1933. I don't think it's fair to say that its roots rested in German religiosity.
I want to turn to the nature of the regionality of Germany, and manifest at one stage in you know, a Germany of over 300 states, and now inherited in the form of a federal republic. How well do you feel that the modern federal republic of Germany, the states that its constituent states, I mean, they obviously, you know, they don't correspond closely to the, you know, the very fractured Germany of the 15th to 18th to early 19th centuries, but have they somehow managed to become successfully kind of replacement sources of local patriotism? Do Germans, I mean, Bavaria maybe is an obvious example, but perhaps, you know, let's say Baden-Württemberg, has that successfully absorbed some of the local regional sources of patriotism that has existed in previous iterations of the German nations, plural?
Well, that's very interesting, actually. That is very interesting. I mean, it's certainly the case that many of these Land bring together, taking up our earlier issue, bring together areas that had not just different political identity, but different religious identity. So if you're looking at Bavaria, Bavaria is preponderantly Catholic. But in the northern parts of Bavaria in particular, not just there, incidentally, there were also quite a lot of Protestants around Augsburg, but in the northern part of Bavaria, around in what's called Franconia, areas like Ansbach and Bayreuth, which had been for a while under the Hohenzollern, they were Protestant. You can see the same thing in Lower Saxony, Catholic areas and Protestant areas. The new Land that were created and that comprised the Federal Republic in 1949, there were not always, I mean, they often came in, as it were, they opposed local patriotism. So, for example, Baden, Württemberg, Baden, and Württemberg Hohenzollern were united in 1951 after, shock horror to listeners, a referendum the previous year. Now, Baden continued to show opposition to this new state. So there was another referendum in 1970, which settled the matter. Prussia, which obviously did have an identity, was divided into new provinces, obviously part of those in East Germany, but in West Germany into Rhineland-Palatinate, into North Rhine-Westphalia, Lower Saxony, and Schleswig-Holstein. So I think, you know, you'd be better placed in some respects to ask German listeners what they think about that. My own view, based on conversations, reading newspapers and such like, is that there are important senses of regional difference that they don't always correspond precisely or even sometimes very much with boundaries and divisions between the land. I think that many of the differences that you will find relate to long-established ones, urban versus rural, Protestant versus Catholic, being two, but by no means the only ones. And that, in a way, the key point is that Germany operates successfully. Now, you might argue it's almost too democratic. I don't believe you can be. I don't believe that's a very helpful concept. But certainly, there are many frequent elections, and the establishment of government in many of the individual provinces is often a process that is quite difficult, and that in turn can be destabilizing or at least affect what's going on at the federal level. Mm-hmm. You saw that, for example, in the former East Germany, the question of political links between the CDU and the extreme right, and how far that was going to be acceptable to the National Party. But what I would argue is that precisely because the German history is that of a multipolar political system, lots of different states, therefore regionalism has a better chance of working in Germany than where these regions are artificial confections. So you may recall that under the administration of Mr. Blair in Britain, there was an attempt to create regional governments in Britain, beginning with yet again a referendum in the northeast of England. And this was in part in response to the political calculations of the Blair government in British terms. And in part, it was a reflection of the European Union's interest in developing regionalism as a way to, as it were, create a political identity for Europe in which the European Union and the regions were the key players rather than traditional national sovereign states. Now, in Britain, of course, there was no real basis for this. I mean, in the northeast of England, as anybody could have told Tony Blair, but Tony Blair, of course, was a, you know, I know he sat for a County Durham seat, but he knew about as much about that as he did about anything outside London. The fact was that in the northeast of England, the idea of being run from Newcastle was completely unacceptable to people who lived in Sunderland or Darlington, Morpeth or Hexham. It was a non-starter. I live in the southwest. In the southwest, the Cornish hate anything which they think of as being run from Devon. People in the southwestern peninsula, as it were, don't like the idea of being run from Bristol. There isn't really a sense of regional identity. Now, in the German case, it may not match the land. So, for example, a sense of being Saxon, which definitely exists, is not very much catered for by the existing provincial boundaries, very different to the position in Bavaria. But nevertheless, there are these regional identities. On the other hand, they don't have much of an ability to operate when there isn't a province that corresponds to them.
And I mean, you mentioned not so long ago that you know, the very democratic nature, the use of elections in the different in the different federal states. There was a time, you know, before the First World War, that, each of them had their own hereditary ruler. And then overarchingly after 1871, obviously with, the German Kaiser. It's been interesting following the death of Queen Elizabeth that one of the countries which seems to felt, one of the European countries that seems to felt most closely involved and interested in, her death and legacies, it has been Germany. I wonder, given the fact that it has no monarchies either at state level or, at federal level, since the end of the First World War, is this a kind of mourning for a, form of German identity or identities that has gone, or actually is there no feeling for that? It's merely curiosity for another country doing something a different way, particularly when that country doing something a different way is led by a monarchy which has a which in the 18th century came from Germany.
Well, that's a fascinating question. I don't see that the Germans as mourning for their own political identity. Most German, I mean, obviously, currently Germany is not in a very happy pace politically, and there is a general view that the difficulties at the present moment are linked to a very much more critical reading of the Merkel government. Now, we know that. But I think, on the other hand, most Germans are aware that their government and their society and their economy is more successful than the situation in most other countries. So there may well be German sense of real interest in the British monarchy, but that does not mean a sense that Britain is a system to emulate. You're absolutely right that the process of moving from a multi-monarchical system, which really, I suppose you could argue, was put into the shade by the strength of the Prussian dynasty, because it's worth bearing in mind that the German Empire, which was proclaimed, so that's the Second Reich, in 1871, only the Prussians were of imperial status. Bavaria, Saxony, Württemberg were kingdoms, but that's all they were. Bavaria, Saxony, and Württemberg continued to have control of their armies, but it was within the German-Prussian dominated system. And as you correctly say, the World War I ended with the the closure of monarchy. Now, it's true that there were significant support for the idea of monarchy in some political circles in the 1920s and early 1930s. And as you know, many of the monarchists had hopes that Hitler would in some way be the means to, as it were, bring in a revived Hohenzollern rule. And it's worth bearing in mind that Mussolini, who was the senior fascist, of course, had his state compatible with the continuation of the House of Savoy, the Italian monarchy. But Hitler had no real interest in a revived monarchy. And it's worth saying that monarchy itself was compromised by the pro-fascist attitudes of the Kaiser in exile in the Netherlands, which included rampant anti-Semitism, incidentally, the attitude of his heir, the Nazi attitudes of his heir. It's not really surprising that monarchy went off the political agenda in Germany. And what is, I would say, interesting is that if you look at Germany or Italy or France, you can see people who are legitimists, as it were, but they are a tiny, tiny, tiny number. And it's not really a viable political proposition. So looking at monarchy in other countries, and after all, let's face it, the problems of the Spanish monarchy means you're scarcely going to look at the other large European monarchy as much of an example, means that, you know, there is a strong curiosity element. And obviously, Elizabeth II played an important role in state visits, in encouraging the West Germany becoming part of the revived, as it were, community of free nations of Western Europe. But there wasn't any real sense that she was a key political player, and the Germans were well aware that figures such as Margaret Thatcher or Tony Blair were much more consequential and important in British politics.
Well, I want to end, and I regret having to end because it's been such a fascinating series, but I want to end really by asking about the kind of the enduring threads, the golden threads of German identity. If you're English, you've got hundreds of years of common institutions of monarchy, of parliament, and from 1707, you can say the same as being British. And there are so many things, despite change and evolution, there are so many things which just run like golden threads through English and British history. Germans look back on the history with things ending, monarchy ending, as we mentioned, institutions, parliamentary institutions coming, going and coming again. A large part of Germany, East Germany, being severed from the rest of Germany and then restored. Other parts of what were once German lands are now part of Poland and so on. What, given this very different kind of long view, is the kind of the ongoing living organic heritage that Germans can look to like a golden thread?
Well, that's a very interesting question. What I would say is this, that the Germans have tried to create an alternative to the idea of the imperial state. In terms of what they call the idea that they have of Heimat, a sort of sense of place, which is sort of an overlapping interaction of multiple identities, including that of religion, of locality, of dialect, of family, of occupation. Now, that was a stress that you can locate back, if you like, in German history. You can go back to in imperial free cities, because a lot of it was an urban sense in the medieval period and early modern period. You can take it as also an element that was deliberately built up in the case of what we call the sort of, you know, creation of history with the institutionalization from the late 19th century and things of like museums of local history, forms of localist heritage, interest in so-called peasant costumes, and a sort of small town and rural Germany, a focus for tourism and culture. Now, the Heimat didn't really work for industrial Germany, and you could argue it was a reaction against industrial Germany. You could argue that the sense of locality, in fact, and obviously a lot of this small town Germany proved to be particularly conducive to the Third Reich, you could argue that that this was an element that was created, but that still has a reach to the present day. You get film genres that were the so-called Heimat films of the 1950s, particularly in Bavaria, and they were sort of revived in the 1980s. Books with the title Heimat in their, the word Heimat in their title, continue to be very common in Germany. So I would say the sense of locality is often a very important one. In terms of a sense of nation, Germans like to talk, you know, those of them who, you know, who are concerned about this, like to talk about things like whether it's Schiller or sport, as it were, culture or television or Goethe. I mean, there are different ways you can look at it and different dynamics. Rather than necessarily thinking in terms of a political expression of Germanness, and that I would say is very much the case at the present moment. Now, there are obviously exceptions to that, and having warned earlier about the role of contingency, I'd be a fool now to deny the role of contingency at the present moment. But I would actually argue that one of the strengths of Germany as an identity is precisely that it isn't dependent on politics at the present moment, or isn't dependent, shall I say, rather on the expression in political forms. And therefore, when those political forms do badly, you know, it doesn't mean, as it were, the collapse of a notion of German.
Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Brief History of Germany, I've hugely enjoyed this series, taking both the long view and the more specific view of different aspects of German history and German identity over the centuries. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And listeners may be interested to know that next week we're going in a slightly different direction. We're going to have a one-off programme about the nature of obituaries.
We are indeed. But for now, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.